who missed a class, list of what I've been doing so far, and including some links here to the particular functions that I'm going to talk about. There's no web page yet for Square 2048, which is a current implementation project for me, but I'll say more about that in the second week of lectures. Let's see, and then all the things that I did last time. Let me start off today quickly summarizing what I said about bit operations. Maybe I should say for the web page, the biggest thing that I'm hoping to put up here is the people who are doing projects. If they want to coordinate, then I can try to list the projects that people are thinking about and say, here's the functions, here's the existing software, here's some speed targets to shoot for. Anyway, people who are doing the projects, you should see me and give me some idea. I've already heard from a few people, but want to get more of an idea of what people are thinking about. So last time, where I left off was as follows. I defined bit operations. There's just one function, an AND gate, which is a bit operation. And then by putting together a chain of bit operations, you can build any Boolean function, any function from M bits to N bits. And in particular, you can do an analysis of, all right, of all the different ways to put together some functions we're familiar with, at least of all the ways we can think of, what is the minimum number of bit operations for these particular functions? So the question here is, what is the number of bit operations needed for example, Poly 1305? A baby analysis cannot answer this question because it only looks at the big O as your sizes go to infinity. And for Poly 1305, unless you say, well, the message length goes to infinity and then the total time is linear in the message length, there's just nothing to say. It's a constant size input. You have to look at constant factors to make a meaningful statement about number of bit operations. But nevertheless, you can generalize the problem. And as you increase the number of bits in the prime you use, increase your security level, as B goes to infinity, you can count the time, the number of bit operations for fast multiplication of integers, division by prime, addition of integers, and that's all you need for evaluating a polynomial modulo a prime. So fast multiplication in particular, mod A prime P, uses, as I've mentioned before, the Schoenhage-Strassen algorithm, B log B log B, bit operations times some constant, which baby analysis doesn't figure out. In other words, per message bit, when you have a 130-bit prime, I was packing 128 message bits in there, and as your prime gets bigger and bigger, you very efficiently pack at least order of b, well, theta of b bits into your b bit multiplication, and that means that per bit of a message, this is big O of log b, log b, bit operations per message bit. Something that scales very, very well with B. And because of that, even without doing a serious analysis, you expect that this is going to be a very fast function compared to some of the cryptographic functions we'll see later for public key operations, which take considerably more bit operations as the security level scales to infinity. You would guess on the basis of this big O, actually big theta, you would guess that the time for this function is pretty good compared to, say, public key operations. You can continue this analysis of bit operations. Again, very simple, mathematically pleasing definition. You can do serious analysis where you figure out the constant factors, or at least bounds, for the big O there. Serious analysis considering constants. And of course, along with the analysis, you try to improve, if possible, optimize your algorithms. Usually, optimization is not something we're able to do, but at least we can improve our algorithms quite significantly. All right, I'm not going to continue down the bit operations line. Instead, I'm going to define an UltraSpark, which is an approximation to CPUs that I'd say more people care about. Maybe I should get some idea. Does anybody here actually still have a Sun? I see one person who admits to having a Sun. Yeah, I think for all the rest of us, there might be some Macintosh users who still have Power PCs, but basically the whole world has switched to x86 Intel or AMD compatible chips, for each of those chips, each CPU, each platform you might be looking at, you have the same question here for every function you might look at. But in particular for Poly 1305, as our first example of a function, you have analogous questions for those cost measures. And I'm going to start with the UltraSpark. As I've mentioned, it's a kind of simplified chip. If you were going to make a chip as a teaching tool, you would make something like the UltraSpark. It shows the important principles of optimizing software for pretty much, improving software for pretty much any CPU without a lot of the complications that show up in some more popular CPUs. It really focuses on the essentials of improving software, improving algorithms from a constant factor perspective without getting too caught up in complicated details. All right, examples of these cost measures. Again, I'm going to start with what is the number of UltraSpark cycles, or to be a little more precise, the number of UltraSpark 3 cycles. Maybe I should put this in quotes. UltraSpark 3 cycles, that is a cost measure for an algorithm needed for Poly 1305. Similarly, certainly of interest to more people is what about the Pentium 3 cycles? Etc. So in order to do this analysis, I'm going to have to start by defining the UltraSpark, which is actually going to take me more than the morning, and then the afternoon I'll tell you, along with some examples in the morning of speeding up software, in the afternoon I'll tell you about doing integer multiplication in software for the UltraSpark 3. So again, let me write down here because it's important. My reason for switching cost measures is that there are lots of people who care about this Pentium 3 cycles, and then UltraSpark 3 is going to be an approximation of that. Pentium 4 cycles, similarly, these are measures that are very important for users. I don't want to diminish the importance of bit operations, which are a good predictor of, for example, power in hardware circuits for a function, but there's many more users doing cryptography in software, and I tend to focus on the biggest number of users, say Google's situation. They're not building chips, at least at last report, but they are using a whole lot of computers where they could be deploying cryptography. I'm going to start with the UltraSpark 3. We'll start with the US3, which has the virtue of being relatively easy to define, and then I'm going to move to popular CPUs. Like the Pentium 3, which is pretty close to the Pentium M, and the Pentium 4 is going to be comparable to the Pentium 3, and then the Athlon, and so on. I'm not going to try to cover every chip out there. I think it's better to focus on a few typical examples and get used to those, and then you can understand the principles you need to apply to any processor that you might be interested in. Let's start with the UltraSpark 3. So what is the UltraSpark 3? Well, it is a chip introduced by Sun some years ago. And I was doing some Google searches for the UltraSpark 3, which is getting kind of hard to find on Google, but okay. Sun processors, UltraSpark 3. According to what I found, they introduced this in late 2000. I don't think they actually shipped it until 2001, but there's a picture of the UltraSpark 3 several years ago. Sun introduced a physical chip called the UltraSpark 3. And here's a picture of the chip. This picture is to scale. It's slightly old technology. This is the actual size of the chip. It has inside it, if you look closely at it, you see an addition circuit, a plus circuit, and you see another plus circuit. And you see some registers, and you see various other physical components of this chip peeling off the cover there and staring deeply inside the chip. And they advertised it as being something more than a teaching tool, but for us it's just a teaching tool. This particular circuit looks kind of like a sequence of bit operations. It is a sequence of bit operations. If you dig into it, then you see, hey, it is exactly feeding some inputs to a particular sequence of bit operations and then producing the output. It can feed the output out of the chip to, say, a person. Which might sound like, wait a minute, how do you compute any function? Well, the answer is this is a sort of universal circuit that, at least for functions up to a certain level of complexity, this circuit can simulate any other computation. But the speed of simulating another computation, another circuit, depends very much on whether you've matched what you're doing to the pieces of this chip. Let me look at these plus circuits and give examples of what the UltraSPARC 3 is capable of doing. Yes, I'd formulated a new Blackboard usage strategy where I move this up. All right, the plus circuits in there are capable of doing an addition of very large numbers. Each of those plus circuits, the UltraSPARC 3 has two of them. Each of those is capable of doing a 64-bit addition every CPU cycle. Each of these circuits can do an addition, a 64-bit addition, once per cycle, every cycle. Not the same 64-bit addition. You get to feed in different inputs into these addition circuits. A 64-bit addition is the function that takes two integers x and y and produces as output x plus y mod 2 to the 64. The input range is x and y also being between 0 and 2 to the 64 minus 1. That's a lot of bit operations. That's hundreds and hundreds of bit operations to do a 64-bit addition, and then there's two of those addition circuits sitting around. What is a cycle? Well, a cycle, depending on your CPU, when they introduced it, I don't think they mentioned clock speed. They haven't mentioned clock speed for years. The original UltraSPARC 3s were 600 megahertz. Newer ones, 900, over 1,000, and then the UltraSPARC 4s are up to 1,200 megahertz, which once upon a time sounded impressive. 600 megahertz UltraSPARC 3, this has 600 million clock cycles per second. 600 times 10 to the 6 cycles, CPU cycles, UltraSPARC 3 cycles per second. And therefore, if you're using it, if you're using the plus circuits thoroughly, then you can do, depending exactly what you're telling the CPU to do, it can do 1,200 times 10 to the 6 64-bit additions, 64-bit adds per second, each of which is a large number of bit operations. So you can do quite a lot of operations. You should think of the 64-bit addition as doing a lot of operations in parallel, and there's two of those 64-bit additions happening in parallel. Okay. There's more on the UltraSPARC 3. It's not just doing additions for you. It can do subtractions and many more operations. Okay, the UltraSPARC 3 has more circuits, and I want to give you some examples of the instructions that are available on the UltraSPARC 3. These circuits inside the UltraSPARC 3 can follow various instructions, many different instructions. There are several different types of circuits inside the UltraSPARC 3. Instructions, which I'll abbreviate frequently as INSINs because I'll be saying it a lot, abbreviated on the board. Examples are, if you say to the chip R equals S plus T, that's the example that I did already. What this means is to compute a 64-bit sum. It means compute R equals S plus T mod 2 to the 64. Another example is R equals S minus T, which means subtracting mod 2 to the 64, producing a result between 0 and 2 to the 64 minus 1, as usual. Another example here, I'm going to use the C notation for this. If you say S shifted left by 7 bits, and to get an idea of how much I have to remind people of definitions, how many people look at this left 7 and say, yeah, okay, I've done C programming and that's okay? All right, I see not everybody, almost everybody. Okay. There's still a few people who are looking at this and going, what? So, okay, maybe I'll remind you every now and then the S left 7. What this means, this is standard C notation, this means that R is 2 to the 7th times S, and again, implicitly mod 2 to the 64. When you're building a circuit, of course, you have some physical limit on the size of your basic operations. If you want to build bigger operations, operations on arbitrary length integers, you have to build them out of these smaller operations, which will be the theme this afternoon. There's some limit, and in the UltraSparx 3, it's a 64-bit chip, which has 64-bit registers, well, 64-bit operations. I'll be talking about registers in a bit. And in particular, this left 7 instruction says multiply S by 2 to the 7th mod 2 to the 64. Here we have two different languages for describing the same operation, one being the C left operation, and the other being this 2 to the 7th times S. One of the artificial difficulties in understanding what CPUs do is that people introduce a new language, it seems, for every CPU. I'm going to try to avoid doing that to simplify the discussion. I'll stick to these two languages, the mathematical description, mathematical notation for what's going on, and the C, or at least close to C, notation for what's going on. Another example of something you can do, you can not just add and subtract and multiply by powers of 2, forming various ring operations, you can also divide. And at this point, let me be careful here. There are two different types of divisions by powers of 2. If you say R is uint 64, S shifted right by 7, then what that means is that R is the floor of S divided by 2 to the 7th. And let me emphasize here that R and S here are between 0 and 2 to the 64th. All of the inputs and outputs here are between 0 and 2 to the 64th, minus 1. So you take S divided by 2 to the 7th, shift it right by 7 bits, throwing away the bottom 7 bits of S, and then keep the quotient, and that's R. The second type of division, what C would call a signed division, the uint 64 is not a completely standard notation. I guess the official one is uint 64 underscore t, which means u is unsigned. No negative numbers here. We've got numbers 0 up to something, int for integer, and 64 for, well, up to 2 to the 64. And then the official underscore t, which I'm omitting here, is to distinguish that from names you might be using in your software for something else under the official C standards. But okay, uint 64 means take an unsigned integer s between 0 and 2 to the 64 minus 1, divide it by 2 to the 7th, the quotient is r. As compared to, if you say r is int 64 without the u, without unsigned, if you say r is signed division of s by 2 to the 7th, then what this means, r is int 64, s greater 7, means that R is the floor of S over 2 to the 7th if S is positive. And what do I mean by positive here? Well, or 0. If S is between 0 and 2 to the 63, then you simply divide it by 2 to the 7th. If it's between 2 to the 63 and 2 to the 64, the top half of your numbers, then you divide it by 2 to the 7th after subtracting a 2 to the 64 from it. To be precise, R minus 2 to the 64 is the floor of S minus 2 to the 64 divided by 2 to the 7th, and that's if S is between 2 to the 63 and 2 to the 64. For instance, if S is 2 to the 64 minus 2 to the 7th, then S minus 2 to the 64th is minus 2 to the 7th. Dividing by 2 to the 7th gives us minus 1, and then floor doesn't do anything, and R ends up being 2 to the 64th minus 1. Similarly, getting more and more fun screensavers here, similarly, if S is 2 to the 64th minus 1, then R is always going to be 2 to the 64th minus 1. It's actually farther away from 2 to the 64th than R can be as well. This operation might seem kind of artificial until you think, okay, wait a minute. Lots of software that's working with these integers doesn't care about the 64 aside from 64 is big enough. Inside writing software, you typically hope that you're not going to bump into the mod 2 to the 64. You just want to have addition of integers. And then as long as they're not big enough, you ignore the mod 2 to the 64. But what happens if you work with negative integers? If you want 2 minus 5, then you say, okay, 2 minus 5. And what the computer actually does is 2 minus 5 mod 2 to the 64, giving you 2 to the 64 minus 3. Which is not what you were thinking of. You don't want to think about the 2 to the 64 typically. What happens if you take some negative number and divide it in half? Well, suppose you have, say, minus 10 and divide it in half. What you want is minus 5. And that's what happens here. If you say, first of all, you make minus 10, 0 minus 10, that gives you 2 to the 64th minus 10. Feed that into the division by 2, say, greater greater 1 means divide by 2. That will take 2 to the 64th minus 10, subtract 2 to the 64th from it, giving you the minus 10 that you were thinking, mathematically, divide by 2, 2 to the 1, if you say greater is greater 1, giving you r minus 2 to the 64th is minus 5. In other words, r is 2 to the 64th minus 5, which you think of as being minus 5. If you're thinking that r and s are representing negative numbers, then this operation makes sense. If you're thinking that r and s are, okay, non-negative numbers, then the first operation makes more sense. Some more operations the UltraSpark 3 can do. I'm not going to give a comprehensive list. If you want the complete definition, then you should look in the Spark architecture manual. Architecture means the set of instructions supported by the CPU, but I'll tell you the important instructions that you need for writing fast software, optimizing, improving your algorithms. If you say R is S and T, then this is 64 parallel bit multiplications. This means that if you take the ith bit of R, this means R sub I is S sub I times T sub I, with R being, write R as a sum of 64 bits times powers of 2, each of the R, S, and T, I won't write it down, but they're implicitly 0 or 1. If R is the sum for I between 0 and 64 of R sub I times 2 to the I, and S is similarly the sum of S sub I times 2 to the I, and T is the sum of T sub I times 2 to the I, then saying, please compute S and T and stick it into R means take all of the bits of S, the corresponding bits of T, multiply them together, take the minimum of each pair of bits and stick it into the bits of R, 64 parallel integer ands. Another example is R equals S or T, and that means with the same conventions for RI, SI, and TI, this means that R sub I is the maximum of S sub I and T sub I instead of the minimum. And one last example, I think this was last on my list, is you can do exclusive OR, and again I'm using the C notation. So C notation is AND for the multiplication of bits, and OR, vertical bar, for the maximum, the biggest of the bits instead of the smallest. And then this caret is the XOR notation, which mathematically people will often say a plus in a circle or just plus mod 2. What it means is R sub I is S sub I plus T sub I mod 2. All right, I think that's enough of a list for now, except I've forgotten about constants. All right, how do you stick some number into R, or how do you say, if you want to say S plus 3, can you do that? Well, you can, actually, but there's certain limitations, which are maybe not obvious at first. You can say something like R equals S plus 314, or simply R equals 314 to stick 314 somewhere, or minus, or anywhere where you see a T here, you can put in a constant. But you can't use an arbitrary number there, up to, say, 2 to the 64. You can replace this 314 by only a number that has plus or minus 12 bits in it, by any number between minus 4096 up through 4095. Now, this is something else that might sound strange at first. Why can't you just say R equals S plus a billion? And the answer is that inside the computer, each instruction, I've been writing down examples of these machine instructions, each instruction is encoded as 32 bits. And inside that, the 32 bits have to select an instruction and point to R and S, and if you have a number in there, include the number. And that doesn't leave very many bits for the number when you realize all the different instructions and all the different places where R and S can be living. There's certainly not enough room for an arbitrary 64-bit number if you encode an instruction as 32 bits. If you want a bigger number, there are some helpful instructions for doing that, and I think this is last on my list of instructions. All right, what have I written down here? This is a built-in machine instruction on the UltraSpark, and it's a taste of the kind of complexity that people stick into their processors, trying to be helpful and sometimes succeeding in being helpful, but it can also be kind of scary when you see stuff like this at first. What I've written down is R equals OXFFFFFC00. That's a hexadecimal constant, which is, all right, almost all Fs. If I had written down 8 Fs here, that would be 2 to the 32 minus 1. I've stopped with C00, and that says I've got 2 to the 32 minus 2 to the 10th. And then the AND is the same bit AND as before, and then I put an arbitrary number there. This instruction, because it doesn't have an S in it, has more space for a number you can put if you count something like 22 bits of constant in here. And what this means is, well, if you know what the hexadecimal means, then you can figure this out. This is standard C notation for it, but mathematically the simplest description is take 1024 times something, where the something is the appropriate bits of the 8675309, namely 8675309 divided by 1024. So compute that, put it into R for future reference. You're allowed to change the 8675309 to anything, but this FFFFFC00, which is restricting what kind of numbers you can get here, the fact that you can get 1024 times anything that's less than 2 to the 32 divided by 1024, that's something that is restricted by the processor. It only has this one specialized and, okay, a few other similar specialized instructions for working with constants. You can change 8675309 to anything that is less than 2 to the 32. All right, and I could keep going. Again, I think these are the critical instructions, but if you want the complete definition of the UltraSpark integer instruction, then you should look at the Spark architecture manual. This is not something which you need to do for the course. For course projects, you can certainly get away with just this list of instructions, and similarly for the Pentium 3, there's a very short list of instructions that you actually want to use. All right, the R, S, and T, where do they live inside the CPU? Well, that's the regs, the registers part of the picture that I drew of the UltraSpark 3. The inputs and outputs of these operations, the inputs and outputs of these instructions, these are stored in the integer registers on the UltraSpark. This is just a name for some storage locations on the UltraSpark. There are 24 usable integer registers. UltraSpark has 24 int regs, each of which is a storage location that at any moment in time holds a 64-bit number, one of the inputs or outputs to these operations. Parenthetically, I will give you the traditional register names. In case you bump into any traditionally written UltraSpark assembly language software and you want some idea of what it's talking about, if you see %i0, that is a specific position inside the UltraSpark. It is the top left of the regs picture inside the UltraSpark. It is the first integer register. It's a storage location for 64 bits. And then there's another one called %i1, and then another one called %i2, and then %i3, %i4, %i5. Does anybody want to guess what the next one is? The fact that I'm asking the question makes it sound scary, doesn't it? It's not %i6. The next one is %l0. What were the chip designers thinking when they made this notation for the locations of registers? Well, you can tell you've been studying these chips too much when these notations actually start to make sense. You can tell what they were thinking with %i and %l0, %l1, %l2, that this actually reflects something sensible about the internal design of the processor and even something that you might want to think about in writing software, but As a first glance, I don't like this kind of notation. I don't like something that requires staring at a chip in so much detail to understand why you would have I0 through I5, and then the percent is just frivolous, but L0 through L5, and then, oh, there is an L6 and an L7, and even that starts to make sense after a while. There's no L8. I don't suppose anybody wants to guess what the next one is. I-J-K-L-M-N-O? It is, in fact, O is the next one. %O0, %O1, %O2, %O3, %O4, and %O5. And now, you might imagine there's some alternation and there's no %O6 and there's no %O7, or you might imagine maybe it's like the L's, maybe there's even more of them, there's O6, 7, 8, 9. Actually, there's an O7 and not an O6. Well, okay, there is an O6, but you can't use it. There's some special spots which have names O6 and I6 and I7, but it's a really bad idea to try to put anything in there. These are the usable registers, and oh, let me not forget %G1 and %G4 and, of course, %G5. Okay, that's a parenthetical list of the 24 UltraSpark 3 registers. And if you find yourself facing something like this, then you should recognize that percent blah blah is probably referring to a physical storage location for a register somewhere in memory. But I don't like making up random notations to reflect what I was thinking in designing a processor, so I'm going to try to stick to C-like notation, C-like code for the things that I'm writing on the board and when I show you software on the computer, stuff that I'm writing there. All right, an example of a sequence of instructions, very simple sequence, just two instructions. If you want to combine these operations, just like combining bit operations, you can combine these bigger operations by doing a sequence of instructions to compute, for instance, 4 times A plus B. Mod 2 to the 64. Well, one reasonable way to do it is you take A and multiply it by 4, which you realize, aha, there's an instruction which does that, shifting left by 2 multiplies by 4. So C equals A shifted left by 2. And then adding B to C, we can say D, the result is B plus C. Okay, that wasn't too hard. And similarly, for any operation, sequence of operations you might have in your head, it shouldn't be too hard to break it down into these instructions. Although, finding an efficient sequence of instructions is a different question, but okay. Traditionally, people would write this sequence of instructions something like the following. Traditional assembly language, ASM notation, which I am going to make sure to avoid, but just to give you an example to appreciate the virtues of C notation, even if you haven't seen it before, you can appreciate that this is easier to understand than, what's the chance I get this right, SLLX, I think. I think that means shift left logical extended. Extended being 64, because in the dark ages the Spark was a 32-bit chip, and shift left is what's happening to the bits here, and logical is doing absolutely nothing here, but well, that's the other L. SLLX, and then A is stored in some physical location, which is maybe %L3, and then 2 gets stuck in here, and then wherever C is, I think that goes on the right, or maybe it's flipped with A, who knows, %O2, for example, and then D equals B plus C has at least the comprehensible name of add, unlike the x86 architecture where the addition has a traditional notation of LEA, that is what they decided to call the addition instruction on the x86. Don't ask questions that you don't want to know the answers to, like why did they call it LEA? Just an example of traditional assembly language will now add O2 to some storage location where B is stored, maybe it's in I5, and then put the result into %G5. Yuck. I am not going to use this type of notation for describing machine instructions for the UltraSpark or any other CPU. I think it's bad enough to have the two different mathematical and C notations. Okay. I think I'm up to saying a little bit about throughput. I hope that the definition of the basic integer instructions here is reasonably clear. Most important thing to understand about the performance of a CPU, the first thing you should look for in analyzing a new CPU is what is the throughput of the instructions. This is one of the three important bottlenecks in any CPU, is the computation throughput. Inside the UltraSpark, there are two integer execution units, which I am going to draw a picture of. UltraSpark 3 has two integer execution units. And these are, well, I started by showing you that inside the UltraSpark 3, there's a couple of addition circuits, each of which can, in parallel, take 64-bit numbers and produce their results. And those are pieces of the execution units. Here is unit 0. Everybody likes to count from 0. It has a plus circuit inside it, and it has a minus circuit, and it has a shift circuit, which, depending on what the shift is doing different things, and so on through the possible operations, including the ones that I haven't mentioned. And then there's the unit 1, which looks exactly the same, and it's another part of the CPU, which can operate in parallel. Unit 1 has a plus circuit and a minus circuit and a shift left circuit, and so on. In the old days of the Spark, the UltraSpark 3 was not quite as good a teaching tool because the units were not exactly the same, and to draw this picture for you, I'd have to say actually the shift circuit in unit 1 is a little less powerful than the shift 1 in unit 0, but okay, the UltraSpark 3 has two completely identical integer execution units. What do these execution units do for you? Well, each of them, each cycle, can do one operation. I started by talking about additions and saying that, well, there's two addition circuits, and every cycle, the addition circuits can both be active. Well, more generally, every cycle, both of these units can be active, but within the units, you can't do multiple operations at the same time. Every one of the integer instructions that I've mentioned, each of the above instructions, is computed, is performed by unit 0 or by unit 1. there's nothing else in the chip that will do an addition instruction for you. There's some different instructions which you might use to simulate additions. I'll talk about that later, but if you say add this integer to that integer, mod 2 to the 64, either unit 0 will handle it or unit 1 will handle it. And each of them can do only one operation per cycle. Unit 0 can do, at best, one instruction per cycle. And similarly, unit 1 can do, at best, one instruction per cycle, can follow one instruction per cycle. From this description of a few pieces of the processor, you can immediately deduce that the number of cycles that any particular sequence of instructions uses, the number of UltraSpark 3 cycles, is greater than or equal to the number of integer instructions divided by 2. You can hope to keep both of the units busy with integer instructions, in which case the number of cycles is exactly the number of integer instructions divided by 2, but you cannot do better. Number of cycles cannot be less than this, because where would your integer instructions go? Pigeonhole principle. This type of lower bound is very important. It's the sort of thing that dictates the performance of your software, along with, I'm going to talk about other effects which are very important for bottlenecks that you try to get rid of, but this is typically something that you can't get rid of. You have some core instructions, some core operations that you really need to do, and you cannot avoid taking at least a certain number of cycles. This type of bottleneck and what do I mean by this type? Well, I mean that the CPU has a limited number of circuits to perform operations for you, each of those circuits having a limited throughput, a limited number of operations it can do per cycle, each with a limited number of operations of some limited type per cycle. This type of bottleneck is the single most important bottleneck, the single most important constraint on the speed of your code. One of the easiest things you can do to write fast software, to make your algorithms run quickly on real computers, is to look at this bottleneck, which you just glance at documentation for some chip, and it'll tell you throughput of this instruction is blah, blah, blah. Sometimes it's not written very well, but people have summaries saying, all right, here's how much various chips can do. If you look at these numbers, you immediately get a lower bound for the number of cycles that your sequence of instructions will take. Now, maybe you can reorganize your sequence of instructions to have fewer instructions, but unless you do that, your number of cycles will be greater than or equal to blah. Whenever you have some sequence of instructions where you're trying to analyze the performance, then the first thing you should do is look for these bottlenecks. So I recommend analyzing these lower bounds for whatever functions you're trying to compute, for every sequence of instructions that you write or that you're looking at. And then when you see how many cycles the instructions are actually taking, you can compare that to the lower bound and see how close it is. And if it's very close, you know that there's no way to improve it without reducing the number of instructions, without reducing the these bottlenecks, reducing the contention for the integer execution units, the competition for additions, subtractions, and so on for those circuits. If you find there's a big gap, then you can reasonably think, okay, something else is making the number of cycles go up, and I'll tell you the two other important reasons that the number of cycles is greater than or equal to something. And those are things you can try to get rid of. You can try to reduce your total number of cycles down to what's dictated by the throughput. of the instructions that you have in mind. If you don't do the lower bound analysis, I see a huge number of people who are trying to do high-speed cryptography or high-speed video games or similar topics and never do these lower bounds and have no idea how close their upper bounds, their actual performance is compared to the lower bounds. And they're just looking around randomly saying, maybe this is something I could speed up, maybe that is, and it's not productive to be spending time randomly thinking I could speed this up, I could speed that up, compared to if you know your lower bounds, you can see the big gaps between your actual number of cycles and this lower bound, like number of instructions divided by 2. Okay, why would software be slower than this? Well, I have some comments on computation latency, and I want to give an example of latency and then compare it to the throughput that you might expect, but first, generalized comments. Suppose that you start one of these instructions at cycle 0, cycle 1, cycle 2. In general, cycles are numbered in some way, and then suppose at cycle n you start an instruction. An instruction that starts, that goes to some integer execution unit, which starts following the instruction, computing the result, that starts in cycle n, finishes computing its result, produces the output, which I've typically been calling r, finishes computing its output in cycle n plus 1. Now, this is not a general principle about instructions. It's a statement about the instructions that I've said so far, namely these integer instructions have 1 cycle latency. As you vary CPUs, as you vary instructions within a CPU, as we'll be shortly seeing examples of for the UltraSpark, you see different latency for different instructions. But at least for these instructions that I've mentioned so far, if you start adding A and B in cycle 5, then the sum A plus B will be computed in cycle 6. You can't use it until it's computed. An instruction cannot start until its inputs have been computed. All right, let's look at an example and compare the throughput and latency constraints in this example. Suppose that I'm going to do a Fibonacci type computation here, actually just using additions. Suppose that I have F0 and F1, and I compute F2, which is F0 plus F1. And you can tell that I'm doing some C-type code here rather than doing mathematics because I've got the numbers adjacent to the letters instead of being subscripts. So F2, if you like, is F0 plus F1 mod 2 to the 64. And then 4 more instructions. F3 is F1 plus F2. F4 is F2 plus F3. F5 is F3 plus F4. F6, no, you can't use F6. No, just kidding. F6 is F4 plus F5. All right, when do these instructions start? Well, the first instruction, if nothing else has happened, let's just label when this starts as cycle 0, if F0 and F1 are ready. And, okay, maybe the computer's been running for a while and it's actually cycle 1,000,000, but I just care about the relative starting times. Then F2 is finished to be computed in cycle 1. Cycle 0, between time 0 microseconds, or, okay, cycle is 1/600,000,000th of a second. And at a certain moment, unit 0 kicks in and starts adding F0 and F1. And then 1/600,000,000th of a second later, one cycle later, it's done. It's computed the sum F2. And now the second instruction can start. is you ignored this dependency between the second instruction and the first, that the second is using F2 as an input, where F2 is the output of the first instruction. If you ignore that, then you might think, hey, there's just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 additions, which can start on cycle 00112 because of the integer execution units. But no, this has to wait for F2 to be ready, so it only starts on cycle 1. And then the next instruction has to wait for F3 to be ready, so it can't start until cycle 2. And the next instruction has to wait for F4 to be ready, so it starts on cycle 3. And then the next instruction has to wait for F5, and so it starts on cycle 4. And the final output, F6, is finally available at the beginning of cycle 5. There are 5 instructions here, and if you compute the lower bound, then you would say, hey, this has to take at least 5 over 2, at least 2.5 cycles, therefore at least 3 cycles. But in fact, it's taking 5 cycles, not the 4 here, all the way from 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, finishing at the beginning of cycle 5. The execution units are definitely not being kept busy here. All of the additions are happening, all of these instructions are handled by unit number 0, by integer execution unit, which I was drawing a picture of before, integer execution unit 0, unit 0. And what about unit 1? Well, it's doing nothing. It's just sitting there idle. Kind of like an undergraduate. It's just sitting there doing absolutely nothing. No, no offense to undergraduates, but there's computation resources which are sitting here which could be put to a good purpose if only we could convince them to wake up and start doing something. So how do we get unit 1 to do something? Well, I have a rewrite of this sequence of instructions. Is it optimal? I don't know. But let's try to use unit 1. Since we're not doing anything with it, let's try doing 2 different additions in every cycle. For instance, let's try taking F2 as F0 plus F1. And in the meantime, let me compute F1 plus F1. Can't think of anything much better to do. And I'll give that the somewhat unintelligent name of F12 as F1 plus F1. And these both start in cycle 0. They're independent. There's no waiting of either one for the other one. Then in the next cycle, let's do the same. F3 is F1 plus F2. And something else you might like to do is multiply F2 by 4, which I'll call F2-4. And how do I multiply F2 by 4? That is F2 shifted left by 2. And these both start in cycle 1. Let's compute F4 is F2 plus F3. And then, I don't know, maybe I'll add F24 to F3. Maybe that'll be useful. And now I've run out of useful names, so let me just call this G. It is F24 plus F3. And all the results are ready. F24 was a moment ago. F3 was a moment ago. F3 was a moment ago. F2 was a while ago. So these all start on cycle 2 and finish on cycle 3. And then F5, I'll compute exactly as before. It's F3 plus F4. And then maybe F6 is equal to, what's the chance it's equal to something like G plus F4? Could I possibly be so lucky? On cycle 3. Okay, let's check and see if this actually producing the same F6. Suppose I had F0 being 0 and F1 being 1. Then I'll just mark this. I don't recommend copying this. I'll be erasing it in a moment. But if I had 0 and 1, then F12 is 1 plus 1, which is 2. And F24 is F2 is 0 plus 1, which is 1. F3 is F24 was F2 times 4. So F24 is 4. And then F3 is F1 plus F2, which is 1 plus 1, which is 2. And then F24 plus F3 is 2 plus 4, which is 6. And what about F2 plus F3? That is 1 plus 2, which is 3. And then how about F5 is F3 plus F4? Well, we know that's going to work out correctly. Same sequence as before. That's 2 plus 3, which is 5. Hello, Fibonacci. And then how about F6 is G plus F4, which is 6 plus 3, which is 9. I don't remember 9. And suddenly I'm worried that... Sorry?
Supposed to be 8.
Supposed to be 8, yeah. Which is making me think that I should have added something else. This is one of the reasons that I have notes. What do my notes say? Oops. I wasn't supposed to add G to F4. I was supposed to add G to F1-2. Oops. Okay, suppose I add G to F1-2. Then that is taking G, which is 6, plus F1-2 is 2, which produces an 8. Okay, at least one of my basis vectors works correctly. Let's try the other one. Sorry about that. So, erasing all the numbers first so I don't get confused. Let's see whether this worked at computing F6 if I started with, instead of 0, 1. Suppose I start with 1, 0, which by linearity will convince me it always works. 1 plus 0 is 1 for F2, and F1 plus F1, 0 plus 0 is 0 for F1-2. F2 times 4 is 4, and then F1 plus F2, 0 plus 1 is now 1. F2 plus F3, 1 plus 1 is 2. And then F3 plus F4, 1 plus 2 is 3. Was I seeing a contribution that it works or doesn't work? Okay, let's see. Then G is F2, 4 plus F3, which is 4 plus 1 is 5. And then F6 is G plus F1, 2, which is 5 plus 0 is 5, which also sounds like a Fibonacci number, so it must be right. Well, okay, in this case, you also go through the computation over here. You take 1 plus 0 is 1, and then 0 plus 1 is, well, okay, F6 is supposed to be F4 plus F5. That's our double check. 2 plus 3 is 5. Yes, I now believe, not just I believe, but I believe I've proven that this code is computing the same F5 and F6, and it's getting it done by cycle 4 instead of by cycle 3. I guess I can leave the numbers there. Again, don't recommend copying them down, but all right. F5 and F6 here have both been computed. We have all the same results after only 4 cycles. Now we have more instructions. There are now 8 instructions instead of 5. Many more instructions, but we have fewer cycles. For this, the execution units are being kept busy. Somehow by increasing the number of instructions, we've increased the lower bound for how long this new revised computation is going to take, but we've also decreased the upper bound. The actual performance here is, in fact, 4 cycles for doing all 8 of these additions. You can write C software that does this, put it in a loop a million times, and it will take 8 million CPU cycles. This is something which is faster than the previous software. Now, it's kind of unsatisfying to have to do all these extra operations. It'd be much nicer if you have something else to do in the meantime to have execution unit 1 working on that something else. Instead of having both of the units busy with many more instructions than you want, it feels like there's lots of redundant work here. There's 8 instructions instead of 5. It's good to look for something completely different to do so that you can keep unit 1 busy. But if this is the only thing you have to do and you're just waiting for F5 and F6 to be available, then you should do these 8 instructions instead of the 5. Question? Do you have to do any work? Well, the more work you do, the more likely it is that something will go wrong. If you just say exactly this sequence of instructions in machine language or traditional assembly language or the C-like assembly language, then the computer will follow the instructions where unit 0 grabs the F2 addition, unit 1 grabs the F1-2, and then the next cycle, unit 0 grabs the F3, and unit 1 grabs the F2-4. You don't have to say anything special. If you simply put exactly what I've written here, exactly this in CASM, which is the assembler that I recommend that you use, I'll be saying more about that tomorrow so people can get started on projects over the weekend. If you write it in C, then you potentially run into trouble with a very smart compiler. And the very smart compiler might look at the software here and say, you know, I have noticed through my super cool algebraic simplification, I have noticed that F6 is equal to F4 plus F5. So I'm going to throw away a whole bunch of operations and replace those by a single instruction. I'm a really smart optimizer. this is another example of optimization being a bad word to use. I'm going to compute F6 as F5 plus F4, and suddenly that makes everything take longer. The latency here of the operations forces F6 to be computed later for the result to be available later. And unless the compiler can find something else to do in the meantime, that will actually slow down your software. To make sure the compiler is not doing that, you can look at the assembly language output of the compiler, which will be written in the nasty traditional percent oh blah 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 language, and well, all right, it's not too painful to figure out that aha, the optimizer is doing something really bad, which is not improving the software. And as you look at bigger examples and higher latencies, which I'll get to, then you see that even worse slowdowns are possible from code optimization. A typical piece of software will be sped up by a compiler because it's written by somebody who's not thinking about the machine at all, and then the optimizer knows more about the machine. But if the optimizer is just, for instance, thinking about it knows the instructions and wants to minimize the number of instructions and is smart enough to realize that F6 is F5 plus F4, then it could slow this down. I think the Sun compiler and GCC are not smart enough to change this code to make it slower. And a simple example like this, if you write it in C, then you will get the same performance as writing it in assembly language. Again, CASM, you can write these instructions. Well, in C, you have to put in semicolons, and in CASM, you don't. Aside from that, you can put it through either of the programming tools with appropriate input and output so you can see what's going on. And if you do that, you will typically get the same performance from a C compiler that you do from writing this in a sane assembly language. But you get more potential for something confusing to happen if you use a compiler, because it'll be transforming your software behind the scenes, rewriting your algorithm to try to improve it in various simplistic and unfortunately sometimes bad ways. Does that answer your question? Okay. Right, so I have these examples, and I like to draw pictures of what's going on in these examples. I like to draw these directed acyclic graphs of the dependencies. So maybe I should have labeled this as the second example here. The first example, again, if I draw a graph for the first sequence of instructions, first instruction sequence, then what does it look like? Well, here's the rules for drawing this type of graph. You take your inputs, put them at the top, and then each output you put below the inputs. F2 is available. It's the sum of F0 and F1, but we don't care about it being a sum or a difference. It's something that has to wait until after F0 is available, after F1 is available. F0 and F1 start being added on cycle 1, on cycle 0, and this is now the finishing time. F-I-N-I-S-H. F2 is finished on cycle 1. And then we add F1 to F2, producing F3, which is, it has to wait for F2 and therefore is not finished until cycle 2. And then F3 plus F4, F2 plus F3 is F4, which is finished on cycle 3. And then F3 plus F4 is F5, which is finished on cycle 4. F4 plus F5 is F6, which is finally finished on cycle 5. That was the original example. And you can see the bottleneck here, what's forcing the sequence of instructions to take as many cycles as it does, is the critical path, which I'm highlighting in the graph, that at the bottom, F6 has to wait for F5, which has to wait for F4, which has to wait for F3, which has to wait for F2, which has to wait for F1. So there is a latency of 5 cycles, and just by looking at that path in the graph, you immediately see that this takes 5 cycles. The computation throughput is not a problem here at all. There's just one addition, one addition, one addition, one addition, one addition on each cycle. So there's much more addition capacity available, much more integer execution capacity available, which is exploited by the second instruction sequence. just like a graph of bit operations is a graph of the additions that the CPU knows how to do. Here was the example. Take F0 and F1, and now there's two additions of those going on, which I'll try to put in the same order as the sequence of instructions. F0 plus F1 is F2, and meanwhile F1 plus F1, which I'll draw with two lines like that, is F12. Those are both finished on cycle 1, and the two additions fits within the two execution units available. Then, where was I? F3 is F1 plus F2, which looks like a diagonal coming down from F1 and straight down from F2. And then how about F24? That is F2 shifted left by 2. And now unit 1 is maybe twisting things around a bit. Might have been a simpler graph if I'd put F24 on the left, but okay, we'll just cross lines and have F24 is F2 shifted left by 2, which is completed on cycle 2. And then F4 is F2 plus F3. And that's straight below F3 and significantly below F2. How about G is F24 plus F3. Both of those are finished on cycle 3. And finally, F5 is F3 plus F4. And then G plus F12 is below G and a lot below F2. And that is F6. These are completed on cycle 4. This graph is much tighter. If we highlight the edges that are bottlenecks here that prevent us from squishing the graph, the edges where their length is the same as the operation latency, we see that F2 is happening immediately after F1, and F12 is happening immediately after F1. Both of those are computed one cycle after their input is available. And then F3, immediately after F2, I'm not going to highlight the F1 because that's not a critical delay there. F24 has to wait for F2. And then G has to wait for both F24 and F3, which are both available just at the right moment. F4 has to wait for F3, F5 waiting for F4, and F6 waiting for G. Here, latency is highlighting these edges as being critical from a computation latency perspective. And then throughput is also preventing us from squishing this more because there are so many additions going on. There's no more integer addition capacity available. All right. I think I'm up to loads and stores, and I'm also up to pausing for some water, which conveniently is here. Are there any questions about these examples of reducing the time taken by some very simple software? Well, I haven't said which of the outputs we're using, and I'm imagining actually that F5 and F6 are both being used for something. And in that case, well, okay, if I declare F5 and F6 to be my critical outputs, then this is the shortest I know for computing both of those. Maybe there's something faster which would compute F6 if I didn't want F5 at the same time. If you throw F5 out of the picture and then imagine other sequences of instructions, actually, this is the sort of thing you can optimize. You can find exactly the optimum number of instructions if you declare here are the inputs, here are the outputs, we're doing something sufficiently simple. Although once you scale up to cryptographic sizes or even much less than cryptographic sizes for your operations, then you are no longer able to optimize. You just have to try to improve, compare to lower bounds, and hope that you have something which is pretty good. But certainly, just as throwing in the multiplication by 4 was important for saving time here, I don't know any other way to get F6 so quickly along with F5. Maybe by doing something different, multiplying by 8 or using some other operations which are not obvious from the original sequence of additions, maybe you can save time in this computation. Anyway, F5 is certainly waiting for F4, and your question was, do we even need F5? If F6 is the only desired output, you can throw F5 and F4, looks like, out of this graph, and then maybe save more time. If you did that, then integer unit 1 would have some free capacity during cycle 3 and cycle 4. Okay, more questions about this speed-up example. All right, that brings me to loads. Okay, what did I have to say about loads? Well, there's this little problem with registers, which is that there's not very many of them. So far, I've been writing these sequences of instructions and just ignoring the fact that they're physically stored somewhere, like in %03. But there's a limited number of places. I said there are 24 usable integer registers, and actually with more work, you can kind of push that to 25 or even 26, but you shouldn't try because it's a lot of pain and suffering. In any case, there's a limited number of registers, and a typical computation does not fit into those registers. There are some exceptions, in which case you can ignore what I'm about to say about loads and stores, but typically something you do in cryptography does not fit into 24 integer registers. Fortunately, the UltraSpark has more storage. Unfortunately, you can't use that storage with these computations. Computations always have to have their inputs and outputs in registers. So you have to copy data back and forth between registers and the memory. UltraSpark 3 has more storage beyond the registers. The picture you should have in mind is that the registers, small number of registers, are sitting there talking to a huge bank of memory. Drawing a picture here so I can put names to the communication back and forth. If you copy from memory to registers, that is called a load. And if you copy from registers to memory, that is called a store. And because there's tons and tons of space in memory, you can fit any reasonable size computation. Typical UltraSpark is shipped with gigabytes. For instance, I've seen some 16 gigabyte UltraSpark 3s, which is a reasonable amount of space. Certainly that's more than you need for a typical cryptographic computation. Even though 24 times 64 bits, that's really pushing it. A billion, 16 billion times 8 bits, that's a reasonable amount of space for storing stuff. Okay, what are the instructions for copying stuff back and forth? Well, here I might be going beyond what some people like to see for C notation for stuff, but here are the instructions, the load store instructions. And I'm going to use a notation that is valid C, but is maybe not the most common C notation, using C pointer notation instead of the arrays that you might prefer. With that caveat, here is something that does work in C. If you say R equals star uint 64 star S, okay, what's going on here? Uint 64, or officially uint 64 underscore t, that is referring to integers between 0 and 2 to the 64 minus 1. It's the type of object, 8-byte object representing integers. If you put a star next to it, that means you have the location in memory of one of those 8-byte, 64-bit integers. If you then take s, which is a register here, it's a 64-bit number, and then put in parentheses uint 64 star before it, it means you should regard s as the location in memory of a uint 64. And then saying r equals star that location means pick up that location, pick up that uint 64, and copy it into r. Well, there's the notation I'm going to be sticking to, and what this means is that you pick up memory bracket s and memory bracket s plus 1 and memory bracket s plus 2 through memory bracket s plus 7 means copy memory bracket s, memory bracket s plus 1, etc. through memory bracket s plus 7 into r. So you compute, this is a function of s if you like, using the memory storage you have sitting around, memory bracket 0, 1, 2, 3 through a billion or so. You pick up memory bracket, say s is 40, then you take memory bracket 40, memory bracket 41. Those are bytes here. Each of the memory bracket S's is one byte. 8 of those bytes forms a 64-bit number, which you copy into the R register storage location. To copy the other way, you just reverse the equals and say star uint 64 star S with appropriate parentheses equals R. And that means to copy the other way, you copy R to memory bracket S, S plus 1, and so on through S plus 7. An immediate question of semantics here is, wait a minute, how do you interpret a sequence of 8 bytes as a 64-bit number? My R's and A's and B's have all been 64-bit numbers, which we're doing arithmetic on. And now here I don't have actually a 64-bit number. I have a sequence of 8 bytes. The answer to the question of how that's interpreted is that the UltraSpark 3 is a big endian computer. And what that means is that for both of these instructions, R as a 64-bit number is equal to the byte memory bracket S plus 7 plus 256 times the byte memory bracket S plus 6, byte being integer 0 to 255 as usual, and so on through 256 to the 7th times memory bracket S. Which is the opposite of what I said Poly 1305 uses, and there's actually, for any particular direction of how you interpret your numbers, you can find a lot of cryptographic functions which go that way, and a lot that go the other way. The modern trend is to use little endian, where you have memory bracket S plus 256 times memory bracket S plus 1 plus etc. And this is a serious issue, because if you have this number and you actually wanted the other number, then it takes a fair amount of shifting and subtracting and so on to flip it around. Which fortunately the UltraSpark 3 realizes you maybe want things the other way, and you can also do little endian on the CPU, but you have to express it differently. If you say R equals star swap endian, which I admit your C compiler doesn't support, but the assembler that I recommend you use does, swap endian uint 64 star S. That means take S, the number S, a location, an address in memory, and then view it as the location of a 64-bit little endian number, pick that up, copy it to R, or you can store the other way. And this says that R is going to be memory bracket S plus 256 times memory bracket S plus 1, etc. Okay, there's more loads and stores you can do. Sometimes you don't want to just work with 64-bit numbers. You can also work with, say, 8-bit numbers and 32-bit numbers, and let me just do one quick list of the possibilities, and then still have some time, good, so I can say a bit about the load and store latency. In particular, the load latency is critical. You can also do, for example, R equals star. Suppose you just want one byte. You can take S and view it as the location of a uint 8, an 8-bit number, well, just a byte, which it is anyway. If you view S as a location in memory, each of the memory locations has one byte in it. R is memory bracket S, number between 0 and 255. Similarly, you can store bytes. You can say star uint 8 star, oops, the 8 is supposed to be right next to the uint, star uint 8 star S equals R. And what that means is, wait a minute, there's not enough space for R to be put into one byte of memory, so you just take the bottom byte of R memory bracket S is R mod 256. And there's intermediate possibilities, and there's signed possibilities. You can do things like star uint 32 star F equals R, and that means that you take memory bracket S, etc., through memory bracket S plus 3, 4 bytes of memory, and you copy into those R mod 2 to the 32 in big endian form. You can also say swap endian for this. Big endian equals R mod 2 to the 32. If you say, instead of uint 32, if you say int 32, leaving out the u, the unsigned, then that says that you should put, actually it says the same thing for storing. If you do that for loading, if you say R equals star int 8 star S, it means take that byte of memory, and instead of treating it as 0 to 255, you treat it as minus 128 through 127, and put that number mod 2 to the 64 into R. If memory bracket S is bigger, is 128 or bigger, then you subtract 256 from it, then take that integer mod 2 to the 64, put it into R. In other words, you copy the top bit of this memory location to all the remaining bits of R past the eighth bit. There's lots of variations of this, but I think I've given you the flavor of the load and store instructions. All right, how fast are the loads and stores? Well, if you thought that latency was a problem, at least a potential problem before, then just wait till you see the numbers for the load latency. I need a new piece of chalk. The throughput of loads, first of all, is 1 per cycle. And then the latency can be gigantic. The UltraSpark 3 has 1 load store unit. And that load store unit is responsible for all of the load instructions, all of the store instructions. The fact that that's the only part of the UltraSpark 3 that can do these instructions is something that you're supposed to read implicitly into the fact that I'm saying there's just one of these units. This unit does at most 1 load or store each cycle. It can at best do 1 load or 1 store. Just like the integer execution units, each can do 1 addition or a subtraction or a shift, etc., per cycle. That means, instantly, another lower bound to keep in mind is that, the number of cycles is greater than or equal to the number of load instructions plus the number of store instructions. Another bottleneck, if you're constantly copying data back and forth to memory, then you're slowing down your computation. Probably you can speed it up. And even more frightening is the latency. Load latency, the time that it takes, number of cycles to produce the output of a load. It doesn't sound too scary at first, but just wait till I get to the end of the list. It is 2 cycles from level 1 cache, which I'll explain in a moment. It is 12 cycles. Yikes, that's the time for doing 24 integer operations from level 2 cache. And it is a gigantic 60 cycles, enough time for 120 64-bit integer additions from what's called dynamic RAM, DRAM. What these caches are doing is trying to save time in latency. Really, memory has a latency of 60 cycles, which is terrifying. But there's some caches that sit there, small pieces of faster memory, that remember your recently accessed data. Your caches store copies of recently accessed data . The objective being to reduce the latency. If registers want a copy of something that's in the cache, then the caches can quickly respond and don't have to wait all the time to go to DRAM. The picture you should have in mind is the following. There are registers, which are 24 integer registers, and we'll add some floating point registers this afternoon. Then the registers are loading and storing conceptually to memory. The instructions don't say anything about these intermediate levels, but physically the registers are first talking to level 1 cache. And this on the UltraSpark 3 is 64 kilobytes of memory. Through the history of computing, numbers between 16 and 64 kilobytes have been very much constant as the amount of fast memory inside your computer. As memory sizes have gone up, they've been memory sizes of slow memory, like level 2 cache, which is a larger chunk of memory, but 12 cycles is a long time to wait for your data. Level 2 cache is considerably bigger than level 1. It's 4 megabytes on the UltraSpark 3. And then finally, there's DRAM, which is what's normally advertised as memory, and that might be, for example, 16 gigabytes, depending on what you purchase with your UltraSpark 3. It's outside the UltraSpark 3 chip. The communication from the UltraSpark 3 chip to this dynamic RAM somewhere else inside the computer is what's responsible for the 60-cycle latency. Speed of light can't even get you your response from DRAM within 2 cycles or even 12 cycles. All right. I have more to say about the loads, and I want to give some examples, especially with floating point, but I think that for now I've said enough, and I'll be continuing this afternoon finishing off loads, and then I get to jump into the speed of floating point, and we'll be able to do some integer arithmetic remarkably quickly with floating point. You might be worried about the instructions I've written down. What about integer multiplication, and how do you break that down into the operations I've described? Wait until you hear about floating point. Floating point will make it really, really fast to do integer multiplication. But I'm out of time for this morning, so I will continue in 3 hours. See everybody at 3:30. Are there any quick questions before? Yeah.
Does it matter how the swap is done when you say swap?
Well, inside the processor, it has a little optional flip circuit, which depending whether you say that you'd like the big endian, the normal thing, or the little endian view of the memory, it either triggers that circuit to swap the bytes around or it doesn't. But that's something which is all hidden inside the cycle. When you load, one of the things that the load unit is doing is copying from memory, and then at the very end, very quickly, it shifts the bits around if you asked for it. It's something where it doesn't change the timing at all. It's just something that, well, it's another instruction you can use if you would like to copy bytes into a register. Viewing those bytes as a little endian number, then you can do it. And if you'd like to view them as a big endian number, you can do it. Conventionally, when people are writing UltraSpark software, they use the big endian. And there's actually more big endian loads and stores that people are able to use than little endian. It's a little more convenient to write your software if you stick to big endian. But if you want little endian, it's just as fast, and you can do it at the expense of just saying a little bit more in your software. All right, so I'll see everybody at 3:30.